Now, I think we do have time for a few, couple of questions at least, and perhaps we can start off with one, and I think probably all the members of the panel, or at least two or three of them, would be interested in answering this. How has the debacle in Iraq and the other American foreign policies, which the Arab leaders have not agreed with, had an effect, a negative effect, on defense cooperation, specifically reducing U.S. leadership and influence?
Tony? Well, I think all of us could answer that question. It is, on the one hand, quite clear from one opinion poll after another, just looking at the shift in some of the arms import patterns to Europe that might otherwise have been purchases from the U.S., that it has had an extremely powerful effect. And I think all of us who visit the Gulf are aware of how many people in the Gulf, particularly the Southern Gulf, are concerned with what happened in Iraq and see this. The term debacle is not necessarily one I would use, but it scarcely is something which met any of the neoconservative objectives that were being discussed before we went in. At the same time, I do think that, A, in terms of actual day-to-day military cooperation and cooperation in counterterrorism, that has often been very good. When it comes down to the discussion of defense issues, training, other areas, to the extent we do have exercises, the cooperation remains. And I think that, as Ambassador Bodin pointed out, the real question may for all of us be not whether mistakes were made in Iraq, but how do you rebalance this structure so the Southern Gulf states emerge diplomatically, militarily strong enough to contain and deter Iran and other threats, remain tied to the United States, and we reduce our presence to much lower levels without eliminating or reducing the confidence that Southern Gulf and other states may have in our presence. The only comment I would make is I don't see any other country than the United States and the Southern Gulf states that can provide any serious military and security cooperation. It isn't going to be Britain. It isn't going to be France. I am not terribly enamored about the idea of it being Russia or China. And until somebody can define where these people are coming from, my experience in watching this situation is they aren't coming and they can't, at least the people we'd like to have, and I suspect the Southern Gulf would like to have, as allies and people who can deter and help secure them.
But any other ambassador?
Yeah, I think that certainly in many places in the Gulf, there is the sense that while debacle may be a strong term, it's not a wholly unjustifiable term. And I think a couple of things that have affected our influence in the Gulf as a result of Iraq. One has been obviously, well, I think one very important one has been a lessening of the sense that the United States really can do. There has been a corrosive sense of our incompetence more than our impolitic approaches. And that has weakened some of our influence. Away from, again, military cooperation, but more on defense cooperation, I think we have also very greatly undermined a lot of the efforts of reformers or liberalizers or whatever term you prefer to use by the way that we have gone about democracy promotion with a very heavy-handed way. One of my concerns would be that there would be and I have heard this at other conferences, that it is absolutely hopeless there and we need to not only withdraw militarily but withdraw politically. And this is not something that I have heard from Gulf states and Gulf friends, that they want us to leave this particular field, but they do want us to restructure how we engage with them on it. And I think in the long term, if you're looking at how do you strengthen them so that they can resist Iranian encroachment and Iranian efforts at regional hegemony. It is working domestically as well as militarily. In terms of other forces or other powers that can come in and maybe not replace the United States as a major guarantor, but certainly supplement it, and one that I've heard increasingly from Gulf states, is not the British and not the French, absolutely, certainly not the Russians, and not the Chinese, but we forget another major regional power that has growing military, particularly naval force projection capabilities, significant investment equities, large oil and energy requirements, and a very large demographic interest in the Gulf, and that is India. And the Indians have become increasingly visible, not just, we tend to think of the Indian presence in the Gulf as just migrant workers. But the populations there are increasingly middle class, increasingly technocratic. Dubai changed some of its property laws, so all of those, that massive building going on there can be purchased freehold, and that includes by Indians. And the Indian Navy is very active in the Gulf. And a lot of the Gulf states look to India as a very attractive supplement, if not replacement, to the U.S. The Indians have good relations with Iran, with the Gulf states. They purchase from both sides, they invest in both sides, and they have increasingly the force projection capability. So I think we need to look a little bit more closely in the region when we start looking at others who might be able to come in and take on some of this burden in a way that many of the Gulf states would find attractive.
Anyone else?
Just Chris? Briefly. I won't add to the sort of characterization about Iraq. I think they covered it well. But I would sort of stress, I think what sustained cooperative relations through some of those dry periods were the programs I described maybe as legacy programs. You know, the existing cooperation on conventional military terms really did sustain, some of the GCC states' faith in the U.S. military, despite the troubles in Iraq. In terms of precedent, I would just note that the National Defense Strategy, the recently issued National Defense Strategy, refers to the free flow of oil, but also of commerce and trade, as a global good. So in terms of the precedent laid down by U.S. national security strategists, they've already sort of opened the door to seeing this as something that doesn't just matter for U.S. national security, but indeed has been codified as a global good. I'm not an expert on the capabilities of the Indian Navy, but I would note that they are making increasing port calls. In terms of deconfliction, but also, there's also a precedent for a sort of cooperative maritime security operations. It's Task Force 150, 151. The folks that are patrolling the Gulf and the Arabian Sea, that's already a multilateral effort to some extent. So perhaps Dr. Korsman or others could comment on the viability of that.
I would like to announce that we are going to conduct this panel through to 11 o'clock. If you want a cup of coffee, please help yourself, but we won't have a break. A rather provocative question, but a very good one. Isn't it time, and perhaps not for this necessarily for this panel, but I think it doesn't directly relate to defense cooperation, however. Isn't it time to publicly repudiate, make a clean break with the neocon agenda that Oslo is dead, regime change in Syria and Iran are necessary? Do these still seem to define our foreign and military paradigm even to this day, or should we repudiate them? Would it be useful? Nobody wants to touch that one.
I guess I'll just say that the judgment on that will be made in less than a week.
Yeah. Okay.
I can't resist making one comment. Some of you here are old enough to remember neoliberals and the best and brightest in Vietnam. And the problem I have is they seem to meet at a common point. The fact is, it isn't whether you're a neoconservative or neoliberal. You either can cope with reality, show some adaptability to other societies and their priorities, and you focus on what you can actually achieve, or you don't. So I would hope that what we get as of Tuesday, regardless of who is elected, as an administration that treats people as partners, focuses on reality, and deals with the art of the achievable, regardless of whether they are neoconservatives, neoliberals, or, as the ultimate threat, vegetarians.
This is a question for Mr. McCray. Jeff, what do you feel led to the situation that allowed the defense contracting company Blackwater to operate the way they did in Iraq, specifically the allegations of misuse of forced death of civilians above the law mentality and so forth? Any comment?
Okay, well, these now are absolutely my personal views, not those of my company or the rest of industry. In a situation like that which they and many other providers of security services found themselves in Iraq, it was a situation characterized by danger every day, by a lack of clear guidelines as to what was expected and what was not expected. The issue of rules of engagement for non-military actors in military scenarios is one that is hotly debated, is one that as an industry, many of participants in that portion of the industry have not come to terms with. I guess ultimately the answer is probably a dangerous situation and a lack of clear guidelines.
Thank you. It seems that many U.S. policymakers are obsessed with Iran now, just as they were obsessed with Iraq before. Do they realize that many Arabs now view the U.S. as more dangerous than Iran? We, the U.S., seem to always be obsessed with finding someone to destroy. Comment.
You know, the reality is Iran does not emerge as a state whose actions are irrational. It does emerge as a state whose actions are consistent. In building up the resources to carry out asymmetric attacks, it does make use, for its own interests, of proxies, groups like the Al-Quds Force, and non-state actors. You cannot look at the Gulf and U.S. dependence on the Gulf, as well as global dependence on the Gulf, and ignore the realities of what it does in terms of missile forces and nuclear forces. Now, does that mean Iran will act irrationally, or that we will have to go to war, or that you can't create security structures or look, as Barbara suggested, far beyond the military dimension? The answers are no. But when you talk about military cooperation, you look either at non-state issues, terrorism, because those are threats you have to deal with, or you look at the actors in the region which represent the most serious potential threats. To sort of wish all of this away is about as dangerous as to become obsessed with worst cases, which may never happen. You have to deal with the realities you face.
If I can just add something on that. An underlying issue, and this gets to something that Mr. Blanchard said, that we haven't really developed a defining principle. I think one of the, and this gets also to the militarization of policy and programs, is that our policy has been defined, and I think it's at least perceived as a negative based. It's who we are opposed to, what we don't like, what we will not accept. And what our rhetoric, and I think to a large extent our policy, has lacked is what are we for, what are we supporting, what are we trying to build? And so this sense of, I think, thinking of us as the most dangerous element out there is a gross overstatement. But certainly the idea that we come across as belligerent and negative as opposed to constructive in any way does very much color the views of our, what are our motives, what are our policies, what are we trying to achieve, and how are we interacting with them and their interests. So shifting from a negative-based foreign policy to a more positive-based foreign policy, I think, is an element of that question.
One more question for Dr. Cordesman. Tony, you talked about the Iranian influence on the Gulf. Can you talk about the Iranian influence on the Caspian Sea and how that might affect regional stability both in and outside the Gulf region?
Iran's influence in the Caspian obviously has created, and I'm not sure in any way I would criticize Iran on this, a pressure for a Caspian solution to energy resources, which Iran's goal, and national views that if they have the energy, they don't want a regional solution because the energy is on their boundaries and they get more money that way. I think that more broadly, when you look at what is happening in this area, you do not see a destabilizing Iranian presence as a key factor in the Caspian states. If anything, it has stood aside from the obvious issue of the Armenians and Azerbaijanis. But what you also see is a group of relatively weak states which are not necessarily all that stable for the future, with a very strong state to the north. And so I think that looking at the Caspian in Iranian terms is not the way I would look at it at all. I would look at it in terms of each of the states involved, and probably more in terms of their ability to take internal decisions which will give them stability and development rather than somebody on the outside being a major problem.
In the late 70s, early 80s, the sale of AWACS to Saudi Arabia was opposed by AIPAC. At the end of the day, the sale was successful, but there was virulent opposition. Would you comment on the situation today, and have we learned any lessons?
Well, let me just make a point. You have to, in the Department of Defense, make a declaration to Congress, obviously, of the sales, and then you have to list what programs are underway. Mr. Blanchard was talking about some of these. You ought to take a look at those declarations because, among other things, we are now upgrading the AWACS with levels of technology transfer, which, if you had anything like the problems we faced during the AWACS debate, would never have taken place. You have quiet cooperation in an awful lot of advanced technologies, not only with Saudi Arabia, but countries like the United Arab Emirates have been able to bargain their way into access to software and code data, which in the past would have been almost unthinkable if the past was AWACS as a time. And in honesty, I think you also have a much more conflicted view within AIPAC and Israel, because you do not hear, when you are in Israel, rhetoric about Saudi Arabia. You hear rhetoric about Iran. You hear rhetoric about the Hezbollah. You hear rhetoric about different kinds of threats. I'm not sure that means we've matured all that much. Certainly, any Arab state has to consider how the Congress will react. And there's been still a lot of congressional rhetoric, which, frankly, isn't all that popular with people in the Israeli Defense Forces or Foreign Ministry, which often see it as more destabilizing and than useful to Israel. which is always a kind of interesting perspective when you come from Tel Aviv and Jerusalem to Washington. Is there still a problem? Yes. Do we have the kind of sensitivities we had then and the practical barriers we had then? No. I think, if anything, the questions asked about Iraq are more relevant. Would Saudi Arabia have made exactly the aircraft purchases it is making today if we had not gone into Iraq, if we had been more flexible in dealing with the problems of the war on terrorism, if we had shown that we were more able, as Barbara has pointed out, to listen? I suspect it might have had a somewhat different purchase profile, but that is not something you can blame on AIPAC.
Thank you. And this is the last question.
Gotta be quick.
No, maybe it's better.
much. Chris, did you have a comment?
I would agree with the assessment that the problems are nowhere near the level that they were. I mentioned process at the end of my presentation because I think it's important. But before that happens, in order to have an effective process, you have to, again, come to shared principles. And increasingly, what that requires is engagement, not only with the GCC partners, for example, but engagement with Israel on the question of their qualitative military edge, but also their commitment to seeing the GCC states have capabilities that are going to be able to meet a potential Iranian threat. Now, when it comes down to the sort of nitty-gritty of engagement with the Congress, the administration, it has choices. You can sort of follow the letter of the law and go to the committees and provide only as much information as you need to provide, or you can present these sales as part of a strategic initiative, building consensus and building commitment among people, not only within the committees of jurisdiction, but across the Congress, that this is important, that those principles are shared by our allies in the Gulf and in Israel. So to that extent, I think we have learned some lessons, and that's why you're seeing a different response this time around.
All right, I've checked my watch, and I think we're actually a little bit over, so that will be the last question. And I want to thank the panelists for some extraordinary presentations.